I'll begin by saying that 2 days from now, Wednesday, is the vernal equinox, the spring equinox. And so as you may know, this is a day that has 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of night everywhere on the planet. And then for the following 6 months in the Northern Hemisphere, days will be longer than the nights. And so we're really entering, you might say, the light half of the year. You know, this great 6 months when there's more light than darkness. And so it seemed appropriate to talk about enlightenment. This curious Buddhist idea, theoretically the quote-unquote goal of Buddhism, insofar as it even could be considered a goal. And of course, there are several problems in talking about this, and talking about enlightenment. I mean, first of all, the Buddhist scriptures make it very clear that it's beyond any verbal conception, you know, so anything I'm going to say is guaranteed to fall short. Another problem is that I don't consider myself enlightened. And so, at least in some schools of Buddhism, it would be, you know, like, you know, what right do I have to talk about it if I'm not there? You know, that kind of thing. At another level, I'll say that I'm an ego talking to a room full of egos, and we're all genuinely convinced that we're separate, that we're different from each other. And we're all genuinely convinced that the experience we're having now is different from whatever enlightenment is. And Buddhism would call all those assumptions into question. You know? So there's all kinds of problems with talking about enlightenment. I guess I want to begin with what enlightenment is not. Enlightenment is not a magic fix-all. Enlightenment is not something that makes all our problems go away. Enlightenment is not a guarantee that we'll never experience pain again. Enlightenment is not an escape from life in any way. Enlightenment does not mean we get to kick up our feet and say, we're done. You know, all these kinds of fantasies of the mammalian brain of what a goal or what paradise might look like. Enlightenment doesn't have anything to do with any of those. Enlightenment doesn't mean that we have a life where we have more of what we like and less of what we don't like than we have now. In fact, enlightenment, if anything, it completely subverts that whole distinction of what we like versus what we don't like. In fact, at this point, I'll read this passage. This is a very famous passage. Some of you may know this. The Verses on the Faith Mind. This was written by Sangsen, the third Zen patriarch. So Bodhidharma is considered the founder of Zen Buddhism. He initiated a follower, Huke, and then Huke initiated Sangsen, who was the third patriarch. And he wrote this beautiful piece, and I'll just read the first few lines of it. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you don't like is a disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. And so this whole Buddhist idea that if I get in this mode of chopping up reality into, well, these are the things I like and these are the things I don't like, in some sense, I'm numbing myself. I'm numbing myself from just the direct, raw experience of what is. And enlightenment is more about contacting that direct, raw experience. You know, there are emotions that we like and emotions we don't like. We like to be happy and excited and hopeful and these sorts of things. We don't like to be sad and guilty and fearful and scared. But all these emotions have tremendous vitality in them. And one way to say it is that enlightenment is the experience of the vitality of being alive, regardless of the emotional flavor that that vitality takes. Now, it's funny because enlightenment is, you might say, realization of the Buddha nature. And in fact, what is the Buddha nature? Fundamentally, pure awareness is the Buddha nature. In other words, under whatever narrative and whatever story we have as we move through life, we're always aware. We're always aware in each moment. And that bare awareness is Buddha nature. It's the closest thing we have, you know. It's, as Tennyson says, it's closer than breathing, nearer than hands and feet. And yet it's so close that we're not even, we overlook it, and then we're constantly running after other things or chasing thoughts or this sort of thing. But that awareness is always there. It's very interesting also in the neurosciences. Scientists have studied the brain quite a bit at this point. And they can say with tremendous precision where emotions are happening, where memories are happening, you know, what happens when I move part of my body, where is that located in the brain, all that. There's a tremendous amount we know about the brain. The one thing that we have absolutely no idea about is how does the brain produce awareness? Why is the brain self-aware? We don't have any idea about that. And it's funny how much that is consistent with the Buddhist teachings. You know, the whole idea that according to Buddhism, when I die, all my stories die, the personality of Mike, all that dies, all my likes and dislikes, all that dies, but the pure awareness goes on. And that's the Buddha nature. So I'll read a couple quotes related to this. There's a famous quote in the Diamond Sutra where the Buddha said, this is a somewhat wordy quote, "Through the consummation of incomparable enlightenment, I acquired not even the least thing. Wherefore it is called the consummation of the incomparable enlightenment." So in other words, when the Buddha became enlightened, at the moment he became enlightened, he gained absolutely nothing. All of us already have what the Buddha got when he got enlightened, you know? It's a kind of paradox. It's already there within us. We're just distracted from it. And we're playing the game of like and dislike, and we're getting pulled away from that primary experience. There's a more poetic take on this from T.S. Eliot. "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." And later on, he just has these two wonderful lines, "A condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything." Which in many ways is a wonderful description of either enlightenment or of, you know, the parallels in the Christian tradition. Now, so far as I've been talking about this, it's kind of a lot of head ideas, you know, pure awareness and this sort of thing. And it's really important to point out that a big part of enlightenment, in some sense the biggest part of enlightenment, has to do with the heart, has to do with compassion. You know, the two primary bodhisattvas in many of the sects of Northern Buddhism, Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, who the flaming sword cuts truth from falsehood, and Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion. And to some extent, enlightenment is this realization of this pure heart of compassion, this you might say, this raw, naked heart that is fully unprotected and fully experiencing the world, tasting the world, exactly as it is. And then probably the hardest part to talk about with enlightenment is it's a kind of bliss, but I'm not there when I get there. You see what I mean? Like, in other words, the me is the primary obstacle to having this experience. One of my favorite quotes, this is not on the quote sheet, but it's one of my favorite quotes from the Buddhist philosopher Wei Wu Wei. He says, "Why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one." And it really is, it's one of the hardest ideas in Buddhism to understand, this idea that my idea of separativity, my idea of having this substantial, fixed, reified, separate self is an illusion. That the only thing that's real is just the ongoing experience. And in some sense, you don't really understand what enlightenment is. You don't really understand what Buddhism is asking unless you get a little angry about it, you know? Like, imagine someone walked up to you and just said, "All your stories about yourself are completely false." You know, that would be a very confronting thing for someone just to walk up and say to you. But to some extent, that's what Buddhism is saying, you know? And so it's a very interesting question, just how attached am I to my stories about myself? How easily offended am I if some of my assumptions about myself are contradicted, you know, or called into question? And it's a funny thing, going back to compassion for a minute, we can't get to enlightenment, even though we have to get rid of our ego, we can't get to enlightenment by having a bad opinion of our ego. We have to have compassion for ourselves as much as for everyone else. You know, it's this this very strange Puritan dynamic that is very, very widespread in this culture, that as long as I'm being nicey-nice to everyone else, I can be completely abusive to myself, but I'm still a good person. Like, that's kind of the Puritan dynamic, you know? And Buddhism just calls that into question. Buddhism really doesn't place a whole lot of belief in the self-other duality anyway. And so, if I'm being abusive to myself, that's just as bad as being abusive to someone else. There's no difference in Buddhism, you know? And I'm going to go out on a limb and kind of guess that, you know, the kinds of people who come to a Monday night meditation group in Berkeley, probably you're mostly kind and polite to other people, but probably the one person in your life that really needs a lot of compassion is yourself, you know? And that's very important. I often think that it's wonderful that life provides all kinds of opportunities for us to break our attachment to our egos. To name a few of the bigger ones, first of all, there's everything around romance and love. I mean, whether it's dating or being in a relationship, I mean, what a wonderful series of experiences to break some of your ego attachments. An even better one is having children. Oh my God. You know, they'll call into question all kinds of things about you. I was a teacher for many years, a high school teacher. So teenagers, they're great. They just say the unvarnished truth to you, you know. Then there's everything about growing old and getting, you know, illness and all that. You know, this life has, it's very humbling. This life has thousands of ways to humble us. It has thousands of ways to take away our dignity. You know, and the question is, are we going to approach that as a way, as a means of detaching from our ego, or are we going to get more and more bitter as we move into those challenges, you know? The The final quote that I'll just share, I don't know, I'm a little bit unclear why I'm sharing this even, but this is the famous quatrain of Bodhidharma himself. This is kind of his summary of Zen. A special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on words and letter, directly pointing to the mind, seeing into one's true nature and attaining Buddhahood. And this whole idea, you know, I mean, certainly books can help and books can correct our perspective and, you know, or someone giving a Dharma talk maybe can give, you know, open our mind to something. But enlightenment doesn't come from the outside. Nothing from the outside does this for us. It's all what we already have. You know, there's a wonderful old Chinese adage, anything that enters through the gate is not family treasure. The whole idea that anything that comes from outside is not the essential worth of one's person. At this point, I'll pass out the quote sheet. Just a scattering of other quotes. This wonderful one from the great Zen writer Dogen Zenji. Do not think you will necessarily be aware of your own enlightenment. That's a fascinating idea, that you might not even be aware of enlightenment when it happens. Carl Jung says, people will do anything, no matter how absurd, in order to avoid facing their own souls. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. Einstein says, the true value of a human being can be found in the degree to which he has attained liberation from the self. This beautiful one from Ramana Maharshi, your own self-realization is the greatest service you can render the world. From Charlotte Beck, enlightenment is not something you achieve, it is the absence of something. All your life you have been going forward, pursuing some goal. Enlightenment is dropping all that. Thich Nhat Hanh says simply, enlightenment is always there. Small enlightenment will bring great enlightenment. If you breathe in and are aware that you are alive, then you can touch the miracle of being alive, then that is a kind of enlightenment. And this is similar to, I didn't include this idea from Dogen Zenji, but he talked about how just being aware on the cushion of one's breath, being aware in meditation, that is enlightenment right there. That's one of the reasons that we bow at the end of the meditation. The whole idea is that insofar as any one of us had a pure moment of awareness in the meditation, there was a Buddha in the room. And so we're bowing to honor all those Buddhas. The Sufi Idris Shah says, enlightenment must come little by little, otherwise it would overwhelm. That's fascinating. Where the strategic mind gets very ambitious about growth. You know, I want it all to happen at once, but we can never handle it all at once, you know. Stanislav Grof says, there's no fundamental difference between the preparation for death and the practice of dying, and the spiritual practice leading to enlightenment. Osho, or Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, as he's sometimes known, it takes a little time to create a gap between the witness and the mind. Once the gap is there, you are in for a great surprise that you are not the mind, that you are the witness, a watcher. And this process of watching is the very alchemy of real religion. Because as you become more and more deeply rooted in witnessing, thoughts start disappearing. You are, but the mind is utterly empty. That's the moment of enlightenment. That's the moment you become, for the first time, an unconditioned, sane, really free human being. K. Ken Kesey says, it isn't by getting out of the world that we become enlightened, but by getting into the world, by getting so tuned in that we can ride the waves of our existence and never get tossed because we become the waves. I like that whole idea. It's not about leaving life, it's becoming intimate with life. Trying Trumpa just says, enlightenment is ego's ultimate disappointment. That's a great one. Eckhart Tolle says, the past gives you an identity and the future holds the promise of salvation, of fulfillment in whatever form. Both are illusions. Amit Ray says, you are never alone. You are eternally connected with everyone. Adi Ashanti says, if there is a path at all, it is emptying yourself of everything you are not. And Cynthia Ocelli says, for a seed to achieve its great expression, it must come completely undone. The shell cracks, its insides come out, and everything changes. To someone who doesn't understand growth, it would look like complete destruction. Much in the same way when a caterpillar goes into the cocoon, it completely liquefies. Like, that's what it has to go through in order to become the butterfly.